Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and this is The Signal.
Mardi Gras turns 40 this weekend, and a lot has changed for the LGBTQI community in that time. But there's plenty that hasn't too.
People are killing themselves because they can't access the proper care and the resources that they need.
If you're trans, the process of transitioning can cost a fortune. But experts say it's life-saving surgery. So, should it be fully covered by Medicare? That's coming up later.
Okay, Ange, how many times do you hear people say things like, I'm sick of this, my rent's gone up, the train's late, traffic's a nightmare, that's it, I'm just going to move to Tasmania.
Yeah, all the time, because it's stunning and they've got delicious food and wine.
Exactly. What you don't hear, though, is people saying this kind of thing.
There is a massive house shortage. You hear stories of people showing up to a rental open home and there's 100 people there.
This woman at the table next to us was really frustrated and was telling her friend that her son had been trying to buy a house for 12 months and that mainlanders just kept swooping in and buying them and pushing the prices up.
Okay, so Tassie's having an election and for the first time in a long time, the fighting is not about forestry.
Yeah, this time it's about pokies, right?
Yeah, that's true. It is. That's a really big issue because the Labor Party has said that it's going to pull pokies out of pubs and clubs if they win government, which they probably won't. But the election's also been about, get this, housing affordability. So to get up to speed on that, I caught up with Georgie Burgess. She's one of the ABC's political reporters in Tasmania.
You've seen a few elections over the course of your young life.
That's right. I am a card-carrying Tasmanian before it was cool.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you're the original Tasmanian. What normally are the issues that crop up during Tasmanian election campaigns?
Well, in the past, elections have been won and lost on pulp mills, logging. Yeah, usually it's issues like that, and they are hugely divisive. And just at the last election, the Liberals vowed to tear up a forest peace deal that had been years in the making, and they were elected to do that and did so in the last 4 years.
Yeah, so there was a forestry issue in the last election campaign.
Yes.
But forestry's not really figuring this time around?
Not at all, yeah. To the relief of many. It hasn't got a mention. There's still calls to stop logging in the Tarkine, but that's not really getting much airtime.
So, I mean, tell us a little bit about broadly, like what's kind of happened in Tassie in the last 5 to 10 years, particularly in Hobart. I mean, things have sort of flipped around quite a bit, right?
That's right. Well, even in the last 5 years, the economy has turned around a lot. The Liberal government that's been in power over the last 4 years have benefited from improvements in the economy. They're taking credit for it, but you know, there's forces outside of that. We've done really well with GST. Mm-hmm. So things are looking up. And of course, this absolute wild card of Mona, the Museum of Old and New Art, the largest private collection of art anywhere. And I mean, no government can plan for that. It's a complete anomaly. Mm. And people are coming from all around the world to come and visit Mona. It's really changed Tasmania's reputation, as now it's this trendy, cool place to come and live. And I think that's bringing young people back.
Yeah. And have you seen that, like, just as a, you know, as you said, like as a card carrying lifelong Tasmanian, do you notice that people that, you know, moved, I don't know, a few years ago thinking that they wouldn't come back and now looking back at Tassie and thinking, actually, it's not such a bad place to live?
Oh, definitely. As someone that went to uni here and stayed here, I'm sort of the exception. A lot of my friends moved to Sydney, Melbourne, London, and I'm at a point now where I'm about to turn 30 and friends are moving back. And it's cool to live here. While housing's an issue, it's still much more affordable than Melbourne or Sydney.
What's the political kind of ramifications of that? I mean, you talked about Hobart being cheaper than the capital cities, but it's not as cheap as it used to be, right?
No, not at all. So the average house price in Hobart is now $430,000. While it's still very cheap if you look at Melbourne and Sydney, but there is a massive house shortage. Mm-hmm. Tasmania's tourism industry is absolutely booming and there was a complete hotel shortage. The rise of Airbnb threw another spanner in the works when it comes to policy and planning because all of a sudden there was a great opportunity there for mum and dad investors and other investors to buy reasonably cheap real estate and make a lot of money out of it by offering Airbnbs. And yeah, I mean, even in the last Real Estate Institute report, it showed that Tasmania needed about 5,000 more homes to satisfy homeowners and renters.
Okay, so that sounds a lot like Sydney or Melbourne.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, a lot of people in Tasmania think it's people from places like Sydney and Melbourne, the mainland, as they say, that are behind the problem.
So that's people who've basically been pushed out of the housing market back home and are looking to Tassie because of, what, the arty buzz and the lower cost of living?
Yeah, and they're also being lured down by Tassie government advertisements like this kind of thing.
You in a year could be living and working in Tasmania.
You in a year could have this as your new home.
You could be close to everything, away from it all, could be on the beach.
And it's affordable!
Yeah, except it's not.
Nope. Well, certainly not compared to how affordable it used to be. And even mainlanders who've bought property in Tassie recently can't believe like how quickly the prices are growing, like Liana Rossi, who moved to Tassie from Sydney last year for a job at Mona.
So I'd been visiting Tasmania. The most recent time was during Dark Mofo in 2017. There was lots of people. I mean, I couldn't walk around Salamanca without bumping into people I knew from Paddington. So it kind of, it was very, Sydney had very much followed me here during those
moved
times.
Moved south for the winter, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
But then you moved to Hobart. Tell us about how you went about finding a place.
We made a very quick decision.
Because you had a job offer down there, right?
Yep, yeah. Accepted a job. We flew down for my interview, mm-hmm. and while I was at my interview, my partner went around to a bunch of inspections, and he was looking in Sandy Bay, North Hobart, and he was going to inspections, and they were just full of people, and I think he saw it a lot quicker than I did because I didn't go to those first round of inspections, and we were kind of like, oh, okay, this is probably worse than we'd read.
Yeah,
and that was 6 months ago, and it's not as bad as it is now.
Right.
But, so okay. We started going to inspections. I would fly down from Sydney and do like 5 or 6 rental inspections and then fly back.
Yeah, and these inspections are almost like a competitive sport, are they?
Yeah, so I was there, people were applying. By that afternoon, I'm getting texts from agents saying, hey, these are off the market now.
Wow.
And that's kind of how it's going.
So you went down thinking that you would get a rental, but it turned out to be a bit even hotter of a rental market than you'd expected?
Yes.
So you sort of thought, well, the rental market's so hot that maybe we're better off committing to buying.
Yeah, which is, and it's, again, all these decisions were made really, really quickly. And fortunately for me, we liked the suburb that we own a house in because I'd seen it for all of 12 minutes before we properly moved in. We really had to fly by the seat of our pants, and it kind of paid off.
And now that you've made that decision and you're living in the house that you bought in Lenna Valley, like, what have you heard about how the market's going, even just, you know, like less than 6 months after you bought in? I mean, what's it like to be a renter there now?
At the beginning, I felt like I got ripped off, which now I don't think that I do, but I spent a lot of time looking at property and seeing if things had popped up and if maybe I'd jumped into something too soon. I read today that the amount of your sort of income that you put towards rent is almost the same in Hobart now as it is in Sydney. You know, even this morning I had a quick look and there's one house that I could see for rent in my suburb. Things are going up and coming down so quickly. The prices seem to be higher. Like I was able to look at about $400 a week when we were originally looking, and now things are more like $490, $500 a week, which,
wow,
you know, people aren't, their salaries aren't increasing at that kind of rate.
Okay, so this weekend, it's the Sydney Mardi Gras 40th birthday, and it's also the first Mardi Gras since marriage equality became law. And a lot of people are talking about how far we've come as a society, how much progress we've made.
Yeah, because of course marriage equality was one of the big goals for decades for that community. But for the trans community specifically, equality still feels pretty elusive.
I don't know, really. I take like a taxi or an Uber, or I try to get a lift from somebody. And if I can't do that, I'll try to find somebody who will walk with me to a train station or catch a train with me.
What's the risk?
I mean, trans women are at a very high risk of murder and assault and sexual assault. The less exposure you have on the street, the better.
That's Cassie Workman. She's a trans woman who's saving up for surgery.
Thank you so much for coming to Comedy-ish. Have a Cassie Workman, good night.
I've been doing stand-up comedy for 10 years this year, and I've been doing it as my main income for probably 7 or 8 of those years.
And stand-up doesn't exactly pay much. And you won't believe how much the various operations cost.
Transition will cost them like $100,000 or more. A huge percentage of us live in poverty and we're underemployed and we find it very difficult to get jobs, obviously, because there's a lot of discrimination. So it leaves us with not a lot of options.
What are some of the biggest costs?
Certainly the major surgeries, like gender reconstructive surgery, like reassignment surgery, is a huge cost, and that can be sort of upwards of 14,000 Australian. Then on top of that, you're missing a lot of work. I estimate mine will be probably 25,000. For a lot of us, facial feminization surgery is necessary, and that includes, you know, reconstruction of the face so that it's not noticeable that you are transgender. And that's probably between $25,000 and $40,000.
Wow, okay. So with a stand-up comedian's salary, how's she getting that sort of money together?
Well, she scraped together enough for the first round of surgery in June, but it's not enough for the next step, which includes facial feminization surgery and, you know, all the other associated costs with transitioning.
Right. And where do you go for these kinds of operations? Like, is it easy to get it done in Australia?
It's really not. Lots of people end up going overseas, which, as you can imagine, adds quite a bit to the cost. I actually spent quite a bit of time looking around for specialists who do this sort of thing in Australia, and I could only find one full-time surgeon who specialises in male-to-female genital reconstruction. That's Dr. Andrew Ives. His workload has increased fourfold since 2011.
So I'm performing what's known as top surgery, which is chest surgery for patients who are transitioning from female to male, and as well as genital surgery, patients transitioning from male to female, and breast augmentation surgery in those, again, male to female patients, as well as liposuction in both categories.
How many people do what you do in Australia?
From the genital surgical perspective, at the present moment, I'm sort of doing most of the surgery. I believe that's certainly what a lot of patients tend to tell me.
How affordable is gender reconstructive surgery, particularly genital surgery?
There is no proviso per se in the public health system for the surgery. It all has to be done through the private system.
So what exactly is covered by Medicare and what's not? Is there any part of that surgery that
you perform? Well, some of it, but I mean, there are item numbers, what we call item numbers, which are codes, surgical codes. There's a group of them that we use to code for the operation and stuff, and those item numbers will have a Medicare fee allotted to them. So, I mean, there is that. And then because there's a Medicare fee allotted to it, again, that's why the health funds will pay on that item number as well. So there is a Medicare rebate for it. But unfortunately, as we all know, Medicare hasn't kept up with inflation and stuff and everything. And so the rebates get less and less.
So just to nail this down, some but not all kinds of gender affirmation surgery are covered by Medicare? And of those that are, they're only partially covered.
Yes. It depends on what you mean when you say covered by Medicare. I mean, is there entirely?
None
of them. None of them are paid for entirely by Medicare. And there is no item number for genital reconstructive surgery and creation of a vagina. So you have to use a grouping of item numbers.
So I asked the Department of Health if there were plans to expand Medicare cover in this area. And in a statement, it said there are already rebates for some surgical procedures. There's also a partial rebate for appointments with specialists. It went on to say that the only way that support would change or increase is if an expert advisory committee recommends it to the government. Andrew Ives says that can't come fast enough.
The suicide rate for the trans community, it's been well documented, is significantly higher than the general population or the across the board. And a lot of patients say to me after surgery, you know, thank you so much, this has been life-saving for me, and we're so grateful, please keep doing it, because you're saving lives by doing this for us.
By that logic, shouldn't the surgery be available for free then?
Of course it should. There is an argument that can be put that when you talk about life-saving surgery, people automatically think of an accident, of trauma. Do you know what I mean? It's not like had an accident, need to have this surgery or you die. Those patients go to hospital, they all get treated, full stop. This is sort of like, you know, if the patient wasn't able to access this surgery somehow, then they might consider trying to end their life.
Was it a life or death choice for you?
Absolutely it was. I knew that I couldn't do it for another 35 years. I knew that there was no way. And that's why I drank and smoked and, you know, did a bunch of drugs and stuff, because I sort of hoped that it would kill me before I ran out of energy. But it didn't, and I'm glad. I haven't experienced happiness like this ever. I haven't, like, ever, like, looked in a mirror and felt good about it. So those are things that happen now. And to have a new name and a new chance to live my life right is just so beautiful. It's the best thing I ever did, hands down.
If today's show has raised any issues for you, call Lifeline on 131114.
And if you have anything to say about this or any of the stories we've covered this week, please hit us up at our email. It's thesignal@abc.net.au. Don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us. It all helps.
We'll be back on Monday.
Bye.